Hi there, Dr. B here with your Module 5 clarifying lecture. I'm coming to you from lovely Allentown, Pennsylvania today. Just got back from Stockholm and I'm already traveling again, but wanted to make sure that you got this clarifying lecture in. Let's start with some general feedback. I'm seeing a good amount of people who are not reading the directions. And I understand we're at crunch time. It's easy to overlook stuff. You just want to get it done. I get all that. But here's the thing. Now is the time to really read all of the directions. Make sure that you're looking at the template. Make sure that you're reading all of my announcements, because, and actually watching these clarifying lectures, because if you're watching these things, I'm going to give you the feedback that you need to succeed. If you're not paying attention to that stuff, then you're going to get a lot of ones and you're going to have to resubmit stuff, and it's just going to take you longer in the long run. I'm still seeing some explanatory fictions and some mentalism. I'm even seeing some references to Freud, as if Freud is complementary to behaviorism. Remember that Freud is pretty much the antithesis of behaviorism, and that you want to make sure that you're avoiding those explanatory fictions. Make sure that you're reading the material before you start to attempt any of your inner teaching or your discussion boards, because you really can't wing it in this class. It's really not possible. We're really precise in the science of behavior, and if you try to wing it, you will get it wrong. So make sure that you're doing everything, for lack of a better term, by the book. All right, let's talk a little bit about the behaviorist bio template. Some of you have not turned in a draft. Please make sure that you do so, because you will not get points unless you put a link onto Blackboard. So you have to click on the draft in Module 5, and you have to submit a link to the Google Doc. Let's say that you got a 1. What does that mean? That's not a permanent grade. What a 1 means is that something is wrong, you need to revise and resubmit. So if you get a 1, make sure that you're reading the comments very carefully and that you're using those for your resubmission. Just a reminder that Module 5 is turning in your template, not your peer review. You turn in your peer review in Module 6. There were some questions about what's acceptable for the video. It has to be a video, which means it needs to go into an MP4 or .mov format. It can't be a voiced over PowerPoint, it can't be a voiced over Prezi, and you can't upload those to YouTube, which is the problem that some people are falling into. Now, what software you use to make that video is completely up to you. You can use Screencast-O-Matic, you can use iMovie, whatever you'd like, as long as it's a screen capture software. You can get fancy and get Camtasia like I use, but it really is up to you. And if you're having trouble making the movie, I would call the Personal Support Center. They can support you. They're around 24/7, 365. I'm not. So, and neither is Scott or Rhea or Elizabeth. So it's really much better if you contact them directly. Another thing, make sure that you sign up for your partner, for your peer review on the discussion board if you have not already done so. And a quick reminder that when you sign up, it is reciprocal. So if you sign up to review somebody's paper, they're going to review yours. So you don't have to sign up multiple times. So I'm seeing some people sign up multiple times. It's not necessary and it's just going to lead to a lot of confusion. Let's talk a little bit about your inner teaching. Please don't use neon colors. I can't read them, and in fact, they're a bit of a migraine trigger for me. So please make sure that you're using more deep, rich fonts when you're writing. The first question, are the signs an SD or are they a prompt? That's a great question. It's going to depend a little bit on your learning history and also your attending skills. So If you only wash your hands in the presence of a sign that says, please wash your hands, then they're an SD. If you wash your hands in other situations, but you're more likely to wash your hands when you see a sign, that's more of a prompt. So what is the SD that you want for washing your hands? Well, it's a sink and soap usually. So that sign should function as a prompt, but it very well may function as an SD. Remember that the term understanding is an explanatory fiction. We cannot measure somebody's understanding. If you remember the Ms. Frizzle rule, if you have to climb into somebody's head and get in the magic school bus and go into their ear, then it's an explanatory fiction. So please make sure that you are checking for your explanatory fictions as much as possible. Remember, too, that SDs, discriminative stimuli, and motivating operations are antecedents. They come before the response. And any reinforcement, even if it comes kind of before or it's signaled before, it's still a consequence. So PREMAC principle, for example, the if-then, the then comes after the response. So it's a reinforcement technique. Reinforcers always, always, always come after the response. And antecedents always, always, always come before a response. So a reinforcer cannot be an antecedent. SDs, S deltas, they're signals that show the availability of reinforcement for a response. So an SD signals that reinforcement is available, and S delta signals that reinforcement is not available. They're not interchangeable, okay? And then the motivating operation is more about the magnitude of the contingency. So an establishing operation is going to make that contingency, those SDs, those reinforcers, that response that much stronger. And an abolishing operation is going to make those SDs, that behavior, that reinforcer, much weaker. So you can't use motivation as, substitute for reinforcement. Motivating operations are what strengthens or weakens a contingency. They're not needs, they're not drives, they're not necessarily cognitive or internal. I know that Skinner talks about them that way, but a lot of the work on motivating operations happened well after Skinner's death. So Jack Michael published his first paper on motivating operations in 1983, and it didn't really pick up steam until maybe 2001. That's a full almost 11 years after Skinner passed away. So you'll see that it's that Skinner's probably going to talk a little bit differently about motivating operations than what you see in the book. I'm seeing this, and I think it comes from, I've seen this in the popular literature as well. Stimulus control is not controlling the stimuli, okay? Stimulus control is a signal that controls responding. So the stimulus has control over the behavior. Okay, it's not controlling the stimuli. So for example, in one of my exercise textbooks, it says, use stimulus control as an intervention. Set your alarm clock for 6 a.m. if you want to get out of bed. That's not how it works. It's not an intervention. Stimulus control is not an intervention. Stimulus control means when my alarm clock rings, I get out of bed. And when my alarm clock doesn't ring, I sleep too late. That's what stimulus control is. It's not about manipulating things in the environment or controlling stimuli. Okay, there are the things that control you, basically, in a lot of ways. So, when my calendar says that I have to be somewhere at 10 o'clock, my calendar has stimulus control over my behavior. I'm trying to think of another one that might help elucidate the two. when I see that the clock hits 6:30, it's time for me to leave my client, so I clock out. That clock has stimulus control over my behavior. Okay, so you're not controlling anything. Now, does it make you respond? No, it can't make you respond. It can trigger a response because reinforcement is available, but really nothing can make you respond. For example, if you had a spinal cord injury, I could put all the discriminative stimuli around in the world and none of those would make you stand up. Keep in mind that it's not so much of a making as it is a signal that reinforcement is available. Also, remember there's no such thing as a feeling of a reward. I see this coming up in the addiction stuff, and I think it's really easy in addiction to get mentalistic because who here hasn't heard of Dr. Drew or hasn't heard of, you know, the 12 steps or whatever. But keep in mind that this is still behavior. It's still controlled by the environment and that a lot of those thoughts and feelings are actually more side effects than they are causes. And so reinforcers are reinforcers, no matter how they make you feel, good, bad, or neutral. Okay, there is no such thing as a feeling of reinforcement. So let's think about some SDs and MOs that could serve for addiction. Well, a bottle of wine could be an SD. I see a bottle of wine, I'm more likely to open it. Maybe if I go to a place that serves alcohol and there's a menu that's put in front of me, that could be an SD for me to order. If I'm in a grocery store that sells wine, I'm more likely to go buy it, which is again an SD. And let's talk about, you know, ads. They could be motivating operations. Withdrawal could be a motivating operation. Let's think of opiates, for example. Somebody is in pain. You take the opiate. That removes the pain. That's negative reinforcement. As the opiate wears off, the pain returns. So now I'm going to take more of the opiate and so on and so forth. And as I build up a tolerance or habituate to it, I have to take more and more and more. And I'm thinking about, you know, Juul is in e-cigarettes and vaping is very much in the news right now. So I don't think that it is a coincidence that we see more commercials for Juul and then all of a sudden kids are using Juul more often because that creates a motivating operation for going to a store that has Juul, which is your discriminative stimulus, and buying that Juul. Or, in most cases, let's be real, you know, you send in your 18-year-old friend to go buy your Juul for you. But those types of responses, a motivating operation kind of sets the stage for things to be reinforcing, whereas that SD signals that that reinforcer is available. I like some of the ideas that you have for shopping, especially with the MOs, the limited time only sale. That's a great transitive condition motivating operation. Someone said if your clothes were burned in a fire, that would be an MO to get new ones. Yeah, definitely, because you don't have any, right? So definitely that would be a motivating operation. Let's talk a little bit about the discussion board. Very interesting questions, very interesting discussion this week. So nice job. Somebody asked, are serial killers responsible for their actions if we're talking about free will and determinism? So if all behavior is determined, is someone really responsible for their actions? And some people were talking about feelings, they were talking about self-reinforcement, and Johnston does talk in those terms sometimes. But often when we say it's a feeling that's triggering a response, it's really some sort of SD outside of our environment that may also trigger some biological stuff. So usually the feeling is actually more of a side effect than a trigger. If that biological response, whether it's an increase in endorphins or serotonin or oxytocin, or our heart rate goes up, or our stomach starts to growl, or any of those things, if those types of things happen after a response, that's actually automatic reinforcement. It's not self-reinforcement. It's automatic because it automatically happens under the skin. Some of the functions that you see in the popular press about things like serial killers and white collar crime and the Me Too movement and things like that, we usually say things like it's internal to them, it's power, it's control, all those types of things. And what Skinner would say is that's very mentalistic, and that those behaviors are really more determined by the environment. And if you look at some of the stuff we're finding out now, there's a lot of that stuff plays out. We tend to see certain behaviors run in families. Now, is that nature or is that nurture? And what Skinner would say is, yes, it's both. It's nature and nurture. You know, some behaviors are passed down through our genetics, but others are passed down through the way that we teach our children and the environments that they're exposed to. So both of those things have the potential for good or harm, right? So you can teach someone to be a kind, loving, generous person, and you can come from a family of kind, loving, generous people, or you can teach somebody to be more self-centered or more likely to engage in problem behavior, or you can teach somebody, you know, and those things can move down the line as well. And are there biological processes that might make people more inclined to, you know, serve as motivating operations, if you will, to engage in certain behaviors, like, for example, brain damage or, you know, certain chemicals not flowing the way that they're supposed to, or a developmental disability that might change people's behavior. Yeah. But remember, it's a perfect storm that you've got some of that biological stuff, you've got the genetic stuff, you've got the learning history, and they all come together to create who we are. So I think that's really important to understand. I was a little bit concerned because I was seeing some references to Freud and conscience as part of, you know, how we learn things. And I want to make sure that you understand that Freud is really the opposite of behaviorism. Okay, so Freud says that everything comes from internal drive states and, you know, it all comes from, you know, the way your mother treated you and all that kind of stuff. And that really hasn't played out in the literature. There's a few things that have kind of been validated in literature, but never mind that it is really hard to validate Freud because it's so mentalistic. But whereas Skinner, you know, you've got nature, you've got nurture, you've got, you know, genetics, biology, and your learning that all come together to form who you are, it's a more parsimonious account. But they really are on two opposite ends of the spectrum. And I want to bring up, this is going to supposed to come up later, but you know, somebody said, can psychology and behaviorism blend? Yes and no. It depends on your orientation. So if you're doing something like dialectical behavior therapy, or we'll find out in a couple of weeks that acceptance and commitment therapy is actually radical behaviorism in action, or you're doing some stuff with cognitive behavioral therapy, then yeah, I would say that we're okay bedfellows. But if you're doing more, and actually too, Rogerian therapy and things like that are really more verbal shaping than they are changing thoughts. Because really, when we change our behavior, we change our thoughts, according to Skinner. Now, if you're doing some Freudian stuff or some of the other stuff that's really super mentalistic and cognitive, I would say probably not, that they really don't get along with each other. But you really have to look at, can you look at your approach from a behavioral lens? Can you look at the antecedents? Can you look at the behaviors? Can you look at the consequences? And can you come up with an explanation that's more natural in nature? And when I say natural, I mean that it encompasses prior learning, biology, and genetics. And if you can, then hey, go for it. But I do find that psych majors often have to unlearn a lot of stuff once they get to me to really get behaviorism. So just something to keep in mind. Some people were talking about self-monitoring or reflection as a way to increase teacher behavior. And certainly self-monitoring has a place in behaviorism. Definitely, no problem with that. But here's the issue. There is a limit to self-monitoring. And it's because, honestly, half the time, actually about a quarter of the time, we know why we do what we do. It's very rare that we know why we do what we do. And usually our hypotheses are maybe about 25% chance of correct. So it really helps to have somebody else take a look objectively and start measuring your behavior to find out exactly what makes you tick. Because there's this idea that we know ourselves the best. And from a behavioral model, that would be incorrect, actually. It would be that we know ourselves the least exact rather than the best. So I want to kind of throw some ideas out there for you. Somebody said something about, you know, cutting corners or being lazy as a result of being stressed. I'm going to turn this on its ear because remember, correlation is not necessarily causation. What if the biological effects of stress are influenced by performance rather than the other way around? So what if the biological effects of stress come from a less accurate, if you will, performance. So what if your behavior actually causes your inner state? This is why we want to be careful of using inner states as causation, because they really, it's a muddy place. And we will contradict this a little bit when we get into rule governance, so stay tuned for that. But remember that our thoughts are behavior. They're just behavior, and they are maintained by all the things that I just said, the biology, the genetics, and your prior learning history. Somebody was talking about behavior analysis not being cookie cutter. Oh my goodness, I am so happy you're here because that couldn't be more true. Behavior analysis is a science, it's not a method. So there is no one right way to implement behavior analysis. It all depends on the situation you're in. You know, and I say this all the time, that it depends. It depends. And it most certainly does. So, you know, whoever said that, you're well on your way to an A in all your courses, because you're absolutely correct. Some people were talking about restraint and how that fits into a behavioral model. Keep in mind that some restraint techniques do not use behavior analytic techniques. Some do, like QBS does, Devereaux does to an extent, Therapeutic Options or TOVA does to an extent. And there are some out there that have not been validated as safe. So buyer beware. You know, just because someone says that they're an expert doesn't necessarily mean they are, right? And if you're interested in learning about restraint from a behavior analytic lens, I encourage you to take a look at Merrill Winston's work. Merrill Winston is his name. And he has some podcasts. The one that I could come up with was the Behavioral Observations podcast, where he's been interviewed about restraint, seclusion, and how to use those from a behavior analytic framework. So if you're interested more about that topic, I would look into his work. It's pretty darn good. So later on, we're going to be talking a bit more about how we view the world and what is reasoning. And we're going to talk a little bit about derived stimulus relations. And basically, what we do is that when we see a new stimulus, we compare it to other categories that we've learned. So I don't have to learn every time I see an orange that it's a fruit. Because I've had so much exposure to different fruits, I've created that category. And we'll be calling those relational frames. Steve Hayes says, learn it in one, derive it in two, put it in networks. That is what you do. So I learned that this orange is an orange. It's sweet. You can eat it. And I also learned that it's a fruit. And then later on, I learned that an apple is also a fruit. And that other apple over there goes with this apple, and they're also fruits, and so on and so forth, until I get to the point where I don't need to learn every single stimulus anymore. So the more exposure I have to these, what we call exemplars, and we'll be talking about this a bit more later on in the semester, the better I am at quickly identify members of that class. And there's all kinds of networks. The networks overlap with each other, and we draw upon those things to respond quickly and appropriately in most situations. All right, I think I covered everything. There was one question about the Google template. If you don't know where the Google template is, it is, you go down into the announcements. It's probably pretty far down at this point. So scroll down that announcements page and you'll see a link to the template that you'll copy into your account. All right, well, have a great weekend, everybody. Hopefully I'll see you earlier next week. We are almost there. So keep up the great work and we'll talk to you soon.